listeners and friends, you are listening to a reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 17th. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. Why don't we go ahead and have a look around today's front page of the TH? The first headline article reads, Making the Case for an Upgrade. Next article, Dubuque makes plans for federal stimulus funds. And the last article on the front page reads, Summer Programs Help Students Remedy COVID-19 Disruptions. And we will jump right into that first headline, which reads, Making the Case for an Upgrade, ED Police, Fire Departments, Spotlight Inadequate Facilities. This was filed by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald. Dateline East Dubuque, Illinois. East Dubuque City Council members toured the city's police and fire stations before their meeting this week. What they saw, particularly in the police station, was eye-opening for recently appointed council member Chad Breimeyer. As I went in the police station, the smell was just overwhelming for me, and to see the conditions our police department has to work in is just awful, he said during the subsequent council meeting. If that was happening to any of our houses, I don't think any of us would be very happy about it. City officials organized the tour to show council members the condition of the buildings and highlight the need for new structures, which the city is planning to build on 4 empty lots at the corner of Sisawana Avenue and 2nd Street. It's outlived its worth, that's for sure, Sergeant Mikey Hausman said of the current police station. The musty smell is apparent from the first step over the police station threshold. In the cells, water drips from the ceiling and pools on the floor. 3 months ago, police stopped holding detainees in the station cells due to the leakage. They now are taken to Joe Davies County Jail in Galena. Upstairs, where the kitchen area is and a meeting room, there is peeled paneling, cracked walls, and chipping tiling. The ceilings and walls show sign of water damage. The garage reveals more dripping water, broken bricks, and rotting beams. Hausman said he was told it had been deemed structurally unsound. The fire station is in better condition, but city manager Loris Herring said the fire department has outgrown the space. Assistant fire chief Tom LeGrain said the kitchen is small, storage is limited, and accommodations are meek at best. Two reclining chairs and a bunk room with one bed for out-of-town firefighters who live at the station when on an EMS shift. The station also lacks a shower room, which LeGain said would be ideal for firefighters to clean up after returning from a fire. The fire department also likely will need replacement trucks in the future, but Herring said the city decided to focus on an updated facility first. He said the police station will be torn down, but the fire station will be renovated and used for city storage. The city plans to fund the construction of new police and fire stations throughout U.S. Department of Agriculture rural development loans. Herring said building is estimated to cost about $3.2 million. Both projects are on track to go out for bid in November or December, with construction beginning next year. Herring said the city hopes both projects will be complete by the end of 2022. In the meantime, the city previously announced that officers would vacate the deteriorating police station and relocate to City Hall. Herring said the departure was not an immediate physical move. Rather, officers now have the option to work out of City Hall. I think everybody envisioned they were going to back up a moving truck and take everything down the street, he said. It's going to be more that the officers can work out of City Hall and run down to the old station if they need something. We're just giving them a clean environment to work. City Hall itself is currently undergoing renovations, on which this council will also hear updates this week. New concrete is being poured on the 3rd Street side to create a sidewalk. New cabinets were installed in the boardroom, and the city will brick in the drive-up window on 3rd Street a relic from the building's former life as a branch of Dubuque Bank and Trust. Hearing said, these renovations are minor compared to the projects the city is tackling with the fire and police departments. While investing a lot of time and money into our public safety, he said, these are basic services that the taxpayers expect. Our next article headline reads, Dubuque makes plans for federal stimulus funds. City has received first half of payments while smaller communities still are waiting. This was filed by John Cruz of the Telegraph Herald. The city of Dubuque has received about $13.2 million of federal stimulus funds promised earlier this year. While that represents about half of what the city is projected to receive, smaller municipalities in the area are still waiting for funding to arrive. The stimulus funds are tied to the American Rescue Plan Act, signed into law in March. It provided $350 billion to be distributed to city, county, and state governments, with each entity receiving different allotments based on population and economic factors. At the time, the city of Dubuque was projected to receive about $27.4 million before federal rules had been released on how the funds would be spent. City Manager Mike Van Milligan submitted a detailed staff memo to city council members laying out how the money would be used if permitted by federal guidelines. The federal rules have since been released, and the plan laid out by Van Milligan most likely will be carried out as originally intended, according to Terry Goodman, Director of Strategic Plan Partnerships for the city. The rules on the stimulus funds pretty much followed what we believed they would be, she said. Van Milligan stressed that while the staff memo submitted by city council members in April still provides a mostly accurate outline of the city intends to spend the allotted stimulus funds, some planned expenditures will likely not be pursued as the city plans continue to evolve. Under the current plan, the city intends to use a portion of the first half of the funds for projects such as providing $250,000 in utility bill assistance for residents, which Goodman said the city aims to begin distributing later this year. The city also intends to spend $850,000 to add 5 miles of street overlay projects and allocate $333,000 for improvements to Grand River Center. About $2.8 million will be spent on reimbursing revenue losses incurred by the city, while $425,000 will be spent on a variety of general fund equipment purchases. Travel Dubuque will be given $472,000 in funds to make up for revenue losses. About $332,000 will be spent on constructing and retaining wall in Jefferson Park. About $1.6 million will be spent on expanding broadband fiber infrastructure in the city. And another $1.2 million will be spent on Catfish Creek lift stations and force main improvements. The city also intends to spend about $2.4 million on various water infrastructure projects. Local businesses and nonprofit organizations also would receive assistance with about $250,000 planned for one-time relief programs. Goodman said these funds likely would be distributed next year in order to give the nonprofits time to access grant relief funding from other federal programs before the city begins distributing its own funds. Funds also would be directed to improving city parks, totaling about $1.4 million in improvements. The remaining funds would be spent on a variety of smaller projects. Van Milligan previously stated none of the funds would be put toward recurring costs of the city due to funds being a one-time allotment to the city. For the second allotment of the funds scheduled to be received in June 2022, planned city projects include 3.35 million. B, Branch Inspector Sanitary Sewer Project, $3 million broadband fiber extension to public facility projects, $465,000 sanitary sewer extension, and an additional $6.65 million put toward the Catfish Creek Lift Station and Force Main Improvement Project. An additional $250,000 would be directed to businesses and nonprofits' grant-assisted program. Goodman said the overall spending timeline for the stimulus funds remains undetermined, but she added that an upgrade will be compiled as soon as presented to the City Council. Goodman added that about 75 city staff members and representatives from local organizations have collaborated in determining the best uses of the funds. The remaining $13.2 million is expected to be spent by the city by June 2022. While the city already has the first half of the promised federal stimulus funds in its possession, surrounding municipalities still are waiting, and some are unsure if the funds might arrive. "We're not exactly positive when we will receive the funds," said Galena, Illinois City Administrator Mark Marin. "I would think it would probably be later this summer." The city of Galena is projected to receive $390,000, while cities with populations of more than 50,000 and counties with populations of more than 200,000 receive their stimulus funds directly through the U.S. Department of Treasury. Smaller entities must wait to have their allotments distributed by local state governments. However, the Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin state governments have not yet distributed those funds. Marion said Illinois state government has yet received its portion of the American Rescue Plan Act funds from the federal government. While local municipalities wait to receive funds, many already have started planning how they will spend the money. Adam Ruschel, city manager from Platteville, Wisconsin, expects the city's first allotment of funds to arrive in late June or July. The city is projected to receive $1.19 million in all. He said the city will likely pursue investing in stormwater infrastructure improvements along with making enhancements to City Hall. "Our building was originally built in 1927, Rochelle said. "There are plenty of things that we could do to make it better." Tim Vick, city manager of Manchester, Iowa, said he was unsure when the city will receive its stimulus funds. It is projected to receive $690,000. The city will likely spend it on replacing a water main, building a new lift station, and replacing an existing lift station, Vack said. "We've done a pretty close review of what can be done with the funds," he said. "Right now, we're just waiting on the funds to be released." Turning over to the third and final front page headline, it reads, "Summer programs help students remedy COVID-19 disruptions." Local educators say keeping kids engaged can help them grow as learners and ease the transition back to school in the fall. This was filed by Ali Hinga of the Telegraph Herald. While the 2020-2021 school year has come to a close in the tri-states, there are plenty of ways for local students to keep learning during the summer months. Local educators said keeping kids academically engaged during the summer can help them grow as learners, as well as make the transition back into school in the fall a little easier. "That's important not just after a school year disrupted by a global pandemic, but any year," they said. "It's going to help some of those transitions back into school in the fall and curb some of that slide for students that may lose some of those gains over the summertime," said Angela Barth, principal of Southwestern Elementary School in Hazel Green, Wisconsin. With summer break now in full gear, educators offered several suggestions to keep kids learning over the summer. Take advantage of school offerings. Educators in multiple local school districts noted that their schools are offering summer programming for children. In Galena, Illinois, school district officials set up a kindergarten through eighth grade incentive program to encourage students to spend time working on reading and math skills, according to middle school principal Ben Soate. Everybody did a great job this current school year of trying to catch up on curriculum and keeping things moving along, but it's still continuing, trying to keep kids going so that we don't have a fallback, he said. Southwestern Wisconsin school district officials offer a summer enhancement program for which more than 200 children already have registered. We're not unique, Barth said. There's offerings all over. Every community tends to have their own offerings. It's just families have to be tapping into those resources. Go to the library. Barth also encouraged families to make trips to their local libraries, which offer programs for children. She recommended parents ask their children what they are interested in and find books that tie into that. Reading is reading, she said. It doesn't necessarily matter what you're reading as long as you're reading, so tap into their interests. Work on literacy. Mandy Paff, an educational support leader for Dubuque Community Schools, likewise noticed the importance of having kids read what they love to read. For older students, picking out a book in the mystery genre can help sharpen their critical thinking skills. For children still learning to read, parents can pull up lyrics to a song and have children listen to the song along so they can see the lyrics and associate them with words being said. Families also can encourage their children to write by having them journal or asking them to write an alternative ending to a favorite book. You can also have children take turns passing around a sheet of paper, each writing a sentence from a story. We want them to have fun, Paff said. Learning can be fun. It's not much fun when you're just given, here's a worksheet to do. It's more fun to be creative with your learning. Play games. Kathleen Condore, Director of Special Education for Holy Family Catholic Schools in Dubuque, noted that playing games as a family can help kids get learning. On a car trip, you can challenge your children to find something that starts with each letter of the alphabet. At the park, have your children look for things that start with a certain letter. Reading a book is fun, but often kids will play a game longer than read a book, Condoroy said. You can keep the learning going if you make it into a game. Use what you have. Jenna Schroeder, a kindergarten teacher and summer school coordinator for the Potosi, Wisconsin School District, noted several learning-oriented activities families can do using common items. You can use a puzzle to talk to your kids about fractions or practice rolling dice and adding the numbers together. You also can find science experiments online to complete with items around the house, she said. For a creative outlet, use water and a paintbrush to let children write on concrete or make musical instruments by filling glasses with water at different levels or putting beads in a toilet paper roll and covering each end. Creativity is a big thing. Having to try and figure it out, and then if it doesn't work, what can they do to change it to make it work? Schroeder said, it's just that problem solving and thinking. Take a break. Condoroy noted that while educators want to keep kids learning during the summer months, even children need time to play and relax. Kids need a little time to recharge too, she said. All right, that is the end of the front page. We will dive into some more local stories. Our next story says, City of Dubuque wages rise in 2020. Despite a drop in overall number of employees because of the COVID-19 pandemic, wages were $855,132 higher than in 2019. This was filed by John Cruz of the Telegraph Herald. The number of City of Dubuque employees declined sharply in calendar year 2020, but overall, wage expenditures still increased from the previous year. there were 999 Dubuque employees listed in 2020, wages in statistics supplied by the city 204 fewer than 2019. Despite that decrease, the city spent more on employee wages in 2020 than in the prior year. Last year, city employee wages accounted for $44,325,744 in expenses, while in 2019, the city spent $43,470,612 on employee wages, resulting in a 1.96% increase. However, the increase in employee spending is far fewer than what it was from 2018 to 19, when the city increased employee wages spending by $4,331,064. In 2020, in response to projected decline revenues from the COVID-19 pandemic, the city implemented a hiring freeze for vacant positions and postponed pay increases in order to reduce overall costs. The 23 unfilled vacant positions in 2020 were projected to save the city about $370,000. A major factor in the decline of total city employment came from a year elimination of summer recreational programming. Dean Kroger, Recreation Division Manager for the city, said about 200 seasonal employees are typically hired every year for summer programming, including about 90 pool staff alone. Kroger said only about a quarter of those seasonal staff were hired in 2020 after a large number of recreational programs were canceled. With the pools not opening last year, it's automatically 90 or so seasonal employees that the city is not hiring, Kroger said. We still hired for some of our neighborhood programs, but we were unable to run a lot of our other programs that year. Kroger added that those hiring issues are continuing into this summer. There, with a number of current seasonal employees between 50% and 60% of what it would be in a typical year. Overall increase in wages was largely due to a small increase in wages for full-time staff. City manager Mike Van Milligan, the highest paid city employee, saw his pay increase from $283,000 in 2019 to $284,000 in 2020, a 0.46% increase. Other employees saw more substantial increases. Alexis Steger, Director of Housing and Community Development, saw her wages increase from $107,000 in 2019 to $112,000 in 2020, a 5% increase. Shelley Stickfort, Director of Human Resources for the city, explained that the city moratorium on salary increases was only in effect for the last 6 months of 2020. Wage increases in the first half of that year, as well as overtime hours worked by city employees, resulted in overall salary expenses rising. However, city employees who earned a salary of at least $50,000 in 2019 saw an average increase in pay of 1.58% in 2020. City Council Member Danny Sprank said the city's efforts to limit wage increases in 2020 were an appropriate attempt to save on expenses during the COVID-19 pandemic. However, he feels that the city could now face pressure to implement more significant wage increases in the future. It's going to be a catch-up for the city this year, Sprank said. It's going to be interesting to balance what we have and what the needs of our and the needs of our citizens. Our next story headline reads, Wildfire Camp Forges Natural Connection. Youngsters spend the week exploring the outdoors at Mines of Spain State Recreational Area. This was filed by Sage Smith of the Telegraph Herald. 20 area students are spending their week exploring Mines of Spain State Recreation Area as part of the Wildlife Camp at State Parks program. The program is orchestrated by University of Iowa and got its start in 2007. The kids preparing to enter 3rd through 7th grade are eligible to attend, and instructors guide them through a wide range of activities. "They're all here because they want to be here and learn," said Wayne Buchholz, who leads the camp and formerly was a longtime park ranger at Mines of Spain. "And some contribute their own knowledge from past camps or camping trips." Wednesday's agenda included a long hike for the younger group and identifying birds for the older group. Kalina Manning, 12, has attended the camp every year it has been held. This marks her last summer before she is too old to attend, but she said she hopes to come back as a volunteer. "I just like how the instructors make it fun and try to switch it up," she said. "Every year, it's always been fresh." A huge hit among kids in both groups was the fire building activity. The kids used small twigs and pine needles along with larger wood pieces to form a teepee and then start a fire. Landon Nisi, 11, said he liked fire building, as well as tie-dye activity. During each kids used berries, leaves, and wood to create colorful shirts. "You get taught a bunch of things you didn't know you wanted to learn," Landon said. The older group of kids sat in a circle with their instructor Wednesday morning to learn facts about birds. Afterwards, they set out off to identify birds they saw and heard. For the Chinois and Michelles, the wildlife camp is a familiar affair. Nora Shorley and her cousins Lily and Maggie Michelle have attended the camp for 2 years. Stella Shinoe, 8, is joining her older sister and cousins for the first year at the camp. "They're not just telling us, we're actually doing it," Stella said about the camp activities. Also attending the camp for the first time is Owen Michelle, 8, the youngest Michelle sibling. Before heading outside, their group decorated their own hiking sticks. Owen's included purple markings and a string of purple beads. So far, a camp highlighted for girls was seeing and petting a baby bird that had fallen out of its nest. The experience was also a chance to debunk a common myth about petting baby birds. "Most people think if you pet a bird, the mom won't come back, but she will," Lily said. The girls said they also caught sight of butterflies, a toad, and 2 rabbits on their outdoor camp adventures. For future camp attendees, 4 girls offered words of advice. "No sandals." Nora and Stella made that mistake once, and while they managed to avoid poison ivy, they plan on keeping their feet covered. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 17th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. At this time in the program, we usually start off with the obituaries, but I have flipped back and forth all through today's TH, and I haven't found any. So with that, I will just move on to the opinion section for today. Starting with the Our View section, the first opinion headline reads, "Degradation of Planet Deserves More Attention." This is an opinion by Siegfried Sutherlin. "In 1962, a little-noticed news item that the international ballistic missiles, which both Russia and the U.S. eagerly developed and tested, dumped vast quantities of exhaust pollutions into the atmosphere. In fact, in the stratosphere, where the air is very thin, the ratio of rocket pollutions to air takes on shocking proportions. In spite of this, governmental and lately ever more private rocket pollutes the stratosphere. Unfortunately, this news item is left no positive results. Soon thereafter, another little noted news item focused on the giant nuclear radiation pollution site at Hanford in Washington State. It stated that the site was dangerously toxic and presented an immediate health hazard on a grand scale. It is the venue where plutonium was produced during World War II for the nuclear bombs. While this news resulted in some corrective measures, they were nevertheless totally insufficient. Decades later, in spite of some cleanup efforts, nearby newspapers reported plutonium-contaminated claims in the Columbia River and nuclear dust in the attics of people's homes. A Hanford Health Network is still active, but no total resolution of the ongoing environmental poisoning has been found. Some cost estimates for the cleanup are now in the tens of billions of dollars, if it can even be done. When this writer drove through the Hanford site, a road sign warned of highway pollution, plutonium contamination. It left me wondering if my car could carry plutonium back to Iowa. Meanwhile, a global plastic pollution exploded seamlessly exponentially in the oceans and in the air abuse above urban areas. Along with exhaust pollution, so some reports have it, it has become a substantial cause of illness and early deaths in urban areas. Again, while minor corrective issues have been enacted, the problem is still getting worse. Though planetary degradation and environmental toxicities receive some attention from the media, pundits, and scientists, they nevertheless do not come close to matching media attention given constantly and relentlessly to celebrities, sports, royal gossip, and the crude utterances and behavior of immature polls. No surprise that in a couple of recent years, our life expectancy actually declined. Some medical experts submit the notion that increasing global pollution entails enhanced moodiness and discontent, if not criminal activities. Add to this that the oceans are used by all navies and ships far too much as a dumping ground for medical waste, if not sewage, and it all adds to a gloomy future and a questionable survival of the planet. Those who are doubtful may want to read John Mitchell's Poisoning the Pacific, a provocative and shocking exposé of the ailing oceans. There are lots of books that carry on the concern of environmental degradation, first popularized by Rachel Carlson in her infamous book of long ago, Silent Spring. The problem resides in the fact that these books are not evoking sufficient popular interest and, above all, appropriate politically entitled policies. Fortunately, on the positive side, global warming was generated lately some major policy initiatives. In the final analysis, sufficient political support will only come once the polls, scholars, academics, and the media will focus on a daily basis on these matters at least as much as the attention that is given to celebrities, sports, and Hollywood gossip. If not, the ultimate cost will continue to rise. Sutherland is a retired from the faculty of Indian Hills Community College in Ottumwa, Iowa, where he resides. Next, we have a letter to the editor. This letter reads, "Teachers must be accepting of all students." From Joseph Delaney of Oak Drive, Dubuque. "I was shocked to hear that a Virginia federal judge ruled to reinstate Mr. Brian Tanner Cross to teach physical education at Leesburg Elementary School in Leesburg, Virginia, after he was suspended for 2 weeks for refusing to refer to students by their preferred gender pronouns. According to its website, Leesburg Elementary School's mission statement says that we partner with parents and the community in order to meet the academic, social, and emotional needs of all students. This is a very important commitment. It is comforting to know that they are committed to meeting the needs of students. But when Mr. Cross decided to disregard his students' pronoun preferences, from which they draw a great deal of anxiety and self-consciousness, he abandoned that mission statement. How is he to properly teach these students and prepare them for the next level of their lives if he refuses to provide an environment where they feel accepted? I know from personal experience that I am not very receptive to a teacher's instructions if they completely disregard and ignore something important to me, especially if doing so does no good to either party. It is my fervent belief that any individual who is hell-bent on ignoring the true needs and feelings of children should never be allowed to teach them. In my opinion, Brian Tanner Cross's employment to Leesburg Elementary School should be immediately terminated, and he should be barred from teaching for any institution of education until he can put his personal biases aside. The last opinion comes from the Our View section, is a national syndication. It reads, Biden's Europe trip symbolizes stability among nations. This is by Arthur Cry. President Joe Biden's trip to Europe provides positive confirmation of collaboration and stability among nations on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. This contrasts markedly with the history of the 20th century. Total wars of unprecedented destructiveness characterized that bloody era. So far, the 21st century has avoided that fate. You would not know that if you relied on major media. Much of the coverage of Joe Biden's trip has been a biased melodrama celebrating the successor to his alarming, destructive, wicked predecessor in the White House. At both the summit of the G7 leaders in Britain and the NATO summit in Brussels, Biden has emphasized the priority of alliances relations. This is a welcome return to the customary U.S. leadership. However, Donald Trump's destructiveness, fortunately, was mainly rhetorical. His complaint that Europe should do more for NATO actually is a sustained theme of U.S. administrators dating back to the early 1950s. History is the anecdote to superficial commentary. NATO, above all, is a remarkably durable alliance. Nations led by the United States and Britain signed the NATO Treaty in Washington, D.C. in April 1949. The influential British weekly The Economist noted during NATO's 70th anniversary that the alliance of the Napoleonic Wars in the early 1800s lasted on average only 5 years. NATO is always growing. On March 27, 2020, North Macedonia became the latest member. Montenegro joined the durable organization in June 2017. Atlantic area nations created the alliance in direct response to Soviet expansionism during and after World War II. By 1949, the Cold War had begun. Today, the organization pursues various diverse missions. The collapse of the Eastern European communist regimes, followed by the Soviet Union, ended the Cold War, but not conflict in Europe. In 2008, Russian troops invaded a portion of Georgia, following an attack by Georgian troops on South Ossetia. Russia encouraged and fostered these breakaway efforts. In 2014, Russia invaded Ukraine and annexed the territory of Crimea. The end of the Cold War was a great victory for the policy of restraint and deterrence, termed containment. Every U.S. president, from Harry Truman, when the Cold War commenced to George H.W. Bush when that conflict ended, supported his foundation security policy. NATO endures for various reasons. Bureaucracies intensively seek self-preparation, and modern militaries prevent potential political lobbies. However, the strategic realities of an assertive, omnisciently effective Russia under President Vladimir Putin is the most important initiative. Putin continually probes for ways to separate Germany from the U.S., also presents it's the danger to of renowned violence among ethnic groups in southern East Europe. NATO today has a range of missions, including, but going beyond, self-defense narrowly defined. Forces have operated well beyond the North Atlantic region, including notably Afghanistan. Humanitarian work includes deploying transport aircrafts and other resources to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. Article 5 of the NATO Treaty states that an attack on one member amounts to an attack on all. The 9/11 terrorist strike on New York and Washington, D.C., and in the sky over Pennsylvania, triggered that clause for the first time. After the final defeat of Napoleon, Britain spearheaded cooperation with the other major powers of Europe to keep the peace. This effort, in fact, maintained general stability on the continent for a century. Today, NATO performs roughly the same strategic role plus humanitarian missions. The Cold War ended 3 decades ago. NATO remains important. Henry Kissinger, diplomacy cry is Coulson designated distinguished professor at Carthage College in Kishona, Wisconsin. That wraps up the opinion section for today. Why don't we take a look at what else is going on? All right, we have a sports story here. It is for Prep Baseball, Southwestern 5, Belmont 2, Wisconsin Divisional 4, Regional Final. Southwestern earns first regional title since 2010. This was filed by Shannon Mum of the Telegraph Herald. Belmont, Wisconsin. The Southwestern baseball team used a quick start along with a gem of a performance on the mound from junior Jordan Stanton to earn its first regional baseball title since 2010 with a 5-2 win over top-seeded Belmont on Wednesday afternoon. The Wildcats, with a record of 9-10, advanced to Tuesday's Division 4 sectional semifinal against Barneveld. The game will be played at 1:30 p.m. in Pexania, with the winner advancing to the 4 p.m. sectional championship against the winner of the Bangor Royal game. "I couldn't be more proud of this group of guys," first-year coach Isaac Stanton said. "They had last year taken away from them, and what they've overcome is just tremendous. We didn't play a home game until the tournament started, so these guys were practicing on the football turf until then. They just never give up, no matter what's thrown at them." Stanton's son, Jordan, played a key role in Wednesday's success on both offense and defense. A first-inning triple down the right field line put the Wildcats ahead 2-0, and his work on the mound was impressive as well. Jordan gave up just 3 hits in 6 innings while striking out 12 batters. Added Jordan, "It's really great for my dad, who is in his first year of coaching, to be able to get to a regional championship. I'm just happy I could do my part. I went out there and gave my best to their best and challenged them. We know we can play with anyone when we play our best." Belmont, with a record of 14-5, had base runners on in the first inning after Tyler Summons' single and an infield error, but failed to get the run across until the bottom of the sixth inning. Southwestern went up 3-0 in the fifth when Jace Mess drew a base-loaded walk, but the Wildcats stranded three in the inning. We struggled early in the season, stringing hits together, and that's something we need to continue working on, Isaac Stanton said. It was extremely important to get the lead early and take things into our own hands. The Beavers used an error in the sixth inning to score Riley Christensen, who pitched 5 1/3 innings for Belmont. Southwestern added a pair of insecure runs in the top of the seventh on an RBI sac fly from Mess and an RBI single from Peyton Edmonds. Edmonds, the lone senior for the Wildcats, finished the game 2-for-4 at the plate. We know that when we got in with our best, we can play with anyone, Jordan Stanton said. It's exciting to know we are another step closer. All right, going over to the lifestyle and arts section, there is a wonderful article about Chef Anthony Bourdain. An act of therapy. Anthony Bourdain doc looks at acute loss through a prism other than the TV personality's death. This was by Jake Coley of the Associated Press. Dateline, New York. When the filmmaker Morgan Nivel began making a documentary on Anthony Bourdain, the late chef and global-trotting television host, one of the first things he did was comb through every song Bourdain ever referenced. He came up with a playlist 18 and a half hours long and called it Tony. Nivel, the director of the Fred Rogers portrait, Won't You Be My Neighbor, and the Oscar-winning 20 Feet from Stardom, was determined to approach Bourdain through a prism other than his death. The music was only a small part of it, but it was a start in making Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain, a celebration of Bourdain's life, not a forensic inquiry, not a eulogy. This was the fall of 2019, when Nivel began. Bourdain's death in June of 2018 by suicide was still fresh. For many, it still is. Roadrunner premiered over the weekend at the Tribeca Film Festival, days after the 3-year anniversary of Bourdain's death. Just the debut of the film's trailer prompted an outcry of emotion and millions of views within days, a rarity for a documentary, showing how many are grieving Bourdain's loss. I've come to think of the film as an act of therapy for the public, Nivel said in an interview. I think for people who only know Tony as someone they were a fan of, like me, there was just this giant question mark hanging over his life because of his death. How the expletive could Tony Bourdain kill himself? That is something people are still grappling with. Roadrunner, which Focus Features will release in theaters Friday, July 16th, goes about answering that question by filling in a fuller portrait of Bourdain. It gives new insight and context to Bourdain's end by following the arc of his life, or more especially, his second life. After years of working as a chef in New York, Bourdain's book, Kitchen Confidential, catapulted him to fame in middle age. In Parts Unknown and other full-flung travel shows that feasted on not just indigenous foods, but a wide spectrum of culture, history, and shared passions, Bourdain became an unlikely and unusually authentic television icon. When Bourdain was found dead at 61 in his hotel room in Strasbourg, France, it was shocking because few seemed so full of hunger for life or greater appreciator of all things worth savoring. Nivel spent the first months on the film not even dealing with Bourdain's final chapter. When he finally did turn to it, he found no easy answers. The way I came to think of it is, Tony was an ultimate searcher and a seeker, says Nivel. But if you are really always seeking and always curious, then you can get lost. He had this tattoo that he got late in life that said in Greek, I am certain of nothing. That sounds very Zen, but it's also a little sad. If you're truly certain of nothing and always looking for something, it means you're leaving everything behind at every moment. I think for Tony, that rootless ultimately disconnected him from the things he should be certain about, like the love of people around him. The interviews from the film Niville considers the most difficult he's ever done. Many of those close to Bourdain were talking about his death for the first time. There was just this sense of group trauma that people were still dealing with, Niville said. I don't think anyone was looking forward to talking to me, frankly. It's not like, oh great, they knew it was going to be a hard time. Several people said it would be the last time they talk about it. I think there was this sense of, let me say it once for the record. That includes interviews with Bourdain's ex-wife, Octavia Boussat, chef friends Eric Rippert and David Chung, TV producers Lydia Tangala and Christopher Collins, and musicians John Lurie and Josh Homme. Homme, of Queens of the Stone Age, recorded a song for the film. There's footage pulled from Parts of Unknown, revealing outtakes and Bourdain's own Instagram stories, which gives small window into his turbulent final year. Niville didn't speak with a few key figures from that time, including longtime cinematographer Zach Zamboni, whom Bourdain fired in that dark period, and the Italian filmmaker Asia Artego, whose tumultuous two-year relationship with Bourdain has for many loomed over his death. Niville was more intent on focusing on the choices that Bourdain himself made and the journey that led to his tragic end. To him, a full understanding can only be elusive. But he suspects Bourdain felt increasingly rootless after his split from Bruja, that when any semblance of domestic life receded, he grew increasingly disconnected from who he was and what he meant to people, including his daughter, that he was maybe too long on the road. When I first sat down with the people close to him, his manager and his production partners, I kind of went on my own rant about why he was someone who was a champion for culture and what connects us. The director said, and they said, yeah, that's true, but he was also an immature 15-year-old boy. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. That became the kind of crux of the making of the film. Reconciling someone who was both so insightful, but also blind to some things. Well, listeners and friends, that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, June 17th. I've been your reader, Maddie Ryan. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And as always, thank you so much for listening.